Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 238th videocast podcast for the week ending May 9th. Got a tremendous amount to cover with you today, so we're going to go through this fast. First, want to invite you to join the Money Show Virtual Expo for accredited investors. That will be on June 13th. I will be a speaker at 9 a.m. You can just click on this link at hedgefundtips.com and you'll be able to attend for free. Many very famous speakers you'll find as you review the website. Check that out. You can watch it right from your computer. And right now the tickets are free June 13th, June 11th to the 13th for the other speakers. We were out in Laguna Beach and La Jolla and San Diego last week for water polo, had an incredible time. That's Caitlin, Mimi, Annabelle at the beach in La Jolla, which was absolutely beautiful. That's me. I got to play Torrey Pines, only 11 holes. It got backed up and I had to get back for a water polo game, but it was still amazing playing the front. Every hole is basically overlooking the water. It was fantastic. Not a bad lie on the course. That's another shot in La Jolla. Another shot at Torrey Pines. And that's that. Moving on, that's the Torrey Pines South. If you ever get a chance to play North or South, South is better. I haven't played North yet, but I intend to, you know, next water polo trip basically is what it comes down to. That's one more there. And then that's Mimi getting punched in the face as she's trying to lay off a shot. Pretty rough crew out there in California. They know their water polo. It's the Mecca. This friend thanks Bo for shooting these incredible pictures of Mimi scoring a goal here. Mimi had five total games. Annabelle, I think, had 16 over five goals, over five games. Annabelle, however, is playing 10 and under. Mimi is playing 12 and under. And it was just great. The teams did wonderful. The coaches were amazing. You know, but that California competition, when it comes to water polo is pretty tight. A couple quick goals here and then we'll move on. But, I was just excited about them. Here's Mimi. All right. That was one. And then I think I've got Mimi again. Watch this pass back by your teammate. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
Sets her up. Yeah. All right, that's me getting a little too crazy. And then Annabelle here. Now, what I love about this is she gets blocked and she keeps following through. And what they call that in water polo, as I'm learning, is get the garbage. So you follow up on your shots and you put it in. Great job there. So let's get down to business here. Rail freight loads continue to rise, pointing to a manufacturing recovery. Remember, we've been in a manufacturing recovery for 2 years, manufacturing recession. So this is very positive. It checked back and now it's reaccelerating. Same with manufacturing versus services, PMI ticking up. These are all important things. Korean exports reaccelerated in April after slowing in March. That's a good leading indicator for the global economy. And new orders to inventories ratio slipped again in April, which shows a little bit of weak orders. But what we are seeing, and we're going to talk about with Generac, is they've worked through all of their inventory now. Their orders to ship are matching, and now they've worked through all that backlog, which is fantastic. And that's going to start to be reflected in their earnings power moving forward. And that's reflected in this chart. The inventory cycle is at its trough. A restocking cycle should begin soon. And this is key, guys. It works on a lag after a recession. And if you remember, for years, I've been saying we had a recession in 2022. The first two quarters of 2022 were a technical recession, two quarters of negative GDP growth. And what do you get? You get a trough following that, like we had in 2010. And then you had many years of a recovery, and you had in 2001, and then you had many years of recovery, and we've just had it now. And by the earnings that we're seeing, whether it's Stanley Black & Decker, whether it's Generac, et cetera. You're seeing that they've worked through those inventories, and now we're going to get the restocking cycle, which accompanies economic growth, which accompanies cyclicals recovering, which accompanies a strong rotation, which we are positioned for and benefiting from already here. Now, what to own in a recovery? Value, dividend players, beta. So this goes through a chart. This is all Bank of America, by the way, thanks to my friend over there who sends me all the great research. And deep value factors had the highest hit rates in a recovery. So that's key. Again, dividend yield, we've covered this chart multiple times. High beta versus low beta positioning is just off all-time lows. So moving away from high betas, as a matter of fact, you're seeing it now with the Robloxes getting smashed, the Shopify's getting smashed, all these money-losing promised profits, manana companies are getting beat down. And I think that cash is going to be king in a higher rate environment, and we're going to be the beneficiaries of that. That's not to say there won't be money-losing companies that become multi-baggers on the promise of the future, but I think now you're going to see these extremes, growth versus value, dividend payers, deep value, all this stuff start to come back. Here's growth versus value, expensive, growth versus value on trailing EPS, expensive. So you can see all this stuff, value versus growth remains two standard deviations below the historic average. And you can see here, this is normal during the destock to restock cycles, which we covered in the last chart here. It gets this low value relative to growth at the inventory cycle lows, which we're just finishing, and then they reaccelerate out of that and dramatically outperform. And those are the type of stocks that we've been covering on the podcast to take advantage of. Obviously, we were buying things like Amazon and Google in fall of 2022 when no one wanted them, and they've had huge runs. I think they will continue to be fine. They will just underperform relative to some of our other holdings that are just leaving the gate. Some of them are up quite a bit already, but I think have a tremendous amount more to go based on where we were lucky enough to buy them. Share repurchase factor coming into play. So there's a lot of key stuff here. For those of you hockey players, I just had to show this hit. That's how defense is played as I was going through some of my Twitter charts here. Watch this hit. I was a defenseman my whole career. Boom. Totally legal hit. Well done. That guy's not going to score a goal. On to RBC, thanks to my buddy over there, pulling up the longer term cycle here. Actually, let's do the short term cycle first, and then we'll zoom out, as I like to say, and look at the longer term picture. Monthly momentum. So this is the S&P 500, broke out of this kind of cup and handle, accelerating. They have a 5,638 initial target. That's probably 2025, but I think we'll make some progress between now and year end. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you some seasonality in an election year, what the summer bodes well. I think we played that 3-8% pullback that we started calling for in Q1 quite well. And we were lucky to take the SMH put spread off in time. It, you know, the SMH went down about 17%, and we were able to make 2.2 to 2.4x. The S&P hedge wasn't as profitable, and the TLT is starting to become very profitable, and that one's going to be on for many, many months. And that's got the highest expected value, which we're pretty excited about. So that's going to, you know, work higher, the S&P. Then you've got Russell. I think this is going to be a huge outperformer relative to S&P here in the back half of the year. We're positioned for that. We like that. And then there are a couple other charts. Obviously, the Hang Seng is finally breaking out. It's now out of bear market territory. Broke through the 50-day moving average for all of the technicians. May come up against a little resistance here because it's moved pretty far, pretty fast. But it's just beginning its ascent now, put in its double bottom, and is working forward, or however you look at it, head and shoulders bottom. etc. And on its way back to the promised land, finally, after 2 years of basing, Tokyo may be more like topping. I'm agnostic, but I know everyone is super bulled up on Tokyo after it's doubled. And I think that, you know, you may be seeing a head and shoulders top here. And this was kind of the safe haven play for people getting their money out of China. Now the money's going back into China. The Japanese central bank has to tighten. I think the game is going to change and everyone's going to be chasing China, chasing Japan at the exact wrong time. Speaking of our TLT trade that we've been talking about for the last handful of weeks, we see yields rolling over, which is very, very constructive. We see dollar now finally letting up after a few weeks of a counter trend strength. And this is going to be do well for our emerging market theme. Here's the 10-year yield rolling back over. Faked a lot of people out here. This is counter trend. The peak was put in October of 2023. If you remember, we were pounding the table in September. It took us like 4 to 6 weeks. Everyone, every week, we're like, look, I'm telling you, it's too crowded. This thing's going to reverse. It reversed like aggressively, and we got that monster, unbelievable year-end rally where everything in our portfolio just went bananas from October through January, Feb. And then you got this little counter trend move in the 10-year yield, and now it's rolling back over. Same thing with the US dollar, peaked in that October 2022, if you remember, when we were buying tech and China got that monster rally. And then now you got this little counter trend and it's rolling back over. This is what we want to see, the dollar re-weakening. This is fantastic. And then Canadian dollar, remember I said, loony long. And as a matter of fact, Buffett at his annual meeting this weekend was saying what? He wants to buy an investment in Canada. He's no dummy. And there are reasons for that. Number one, the secular trend in commodities. Number two, he'll get a double bite at the apple with Canadian dollar appreciation. And number three, the valuations are probably lower relative to other opportunities he can find around the world. Okay, that's oil's coming a little bit. Remember, everyone was chasing up. Gold, no view. I mean, that's just... it is what it is. Copper, Dr. Copper has a PhD in economics. That's basically a proxy for what's coming down the pike in China over the next 6 to 12 months. I think that's constructive. Copper futures going through the roof. So that's basically everything I wanted to cover from this group. We did a lot more general market stuff last week when we did the Jerome Powell Let There Be Light stock market and sentiment results. You can find that at hedgefundtips.com under commentary. The other thing you can also find at hedgefundtips.com is the terms, not advice. This is opinion only. We deal exclusively with accredited investors and qualified institutions. So you should consult with a financial advisor before you do anything. This is for educational and informational and entertainment purposes only. Okay, now the long view, to remind you and to instruct the newer people that have been listening. This is also from Robert Slumer at RBC. This is the long-term cycle where you have basically 16 to 18 years of sideways consolidation and grind, which we just finished up in 2015, followed by, you know, 16 to 18 years of a bull market, and then sideways consolidation, bull market, sideways consolidation, bull market. What you want to overlay with these is makes it very simple, is the demography of the country. And namely, you get these periods right here from of 20-year bulls from when you have the bulk of the population between, you know, call it late 20s and mid 40s, and that's what gives you a 16 to 18 year run, and then you consolidate it, which we went through with two big crashes in the 70s, two big crashes in the 30s, two big crashes in the early 2000s. And now we're about halfway through the 16 to 18 year cycle of a secular bull that will probably run into the early 30s. and we want to ride that wave, and it's good times here. Okay, so that gives you a view of the longer term cycle. Emerging markets, you can see, has been in there. Long-term consolidation getting ready to break out. That's going to be commensurate with the US dollar, and that will take off as we have favorable demographics in those markets. Looks like the 10-year yield stopped out here. Dollar, another chart here, rolling back over. And I do think we have the potentiality to see a similar type dramatic rollover in the dollar that we saw in the early 2000s over the next few years. We don't need that for our emerging market theses and biotech and all of that stuff to work out. But I think that's a more likely scenario in the early stages before they're able to inflate some of the debt away. You're going to see a weakening of the dollar. People are going to sniff out our fiscal irresponsibility in the last few years. And we're positioned for that. So we've covered the groups that do well in the early parts of the cycle, meaning China and emerging markets. So we're positioned for that. Autos start to do better, which, you know, we're going to talk about volumes. And then you start to see REITs, which we've been talking about. Utilities have already taken off. We were pounding the table on that. Biotech position for that. Energy, we've got Comstock Resources. Payment processors, which is interesting. That is going to be PayPal for us. So pretty exciting stuff here. Quote of the week from Warren Buffett. I never buy anything unless I can fill out on a piece of paper my reasons. I may be wrong, but I would know the answer to that. I'm paying $32 billion today for the Coca-Cola company because if you can't answer that question, you shouldn't buy it. If you can answer that question and you can do it a few times, you'll make a lot of money. And I think that's the issue. If you ask 10 people, why do you own Roblox today? I think the answer to their question would be very convoluted. You know, how do you justify a company that generates, you know, $74 million of cash trading at $30 billion. And the answer is you are making some fantasy bet on some virtual world that's going to change the world. Now, I'm not discounting that they have value. I see my kids on it and I try to keep them off it, but they keep going back on it and their friends are on it. And that's going to continue to grow. And it's their ecosystem. But whether that $74 million of cash is worth $30 billion, I'm willing to bet it's not. So that's that. The type of businesses we own, similar to Buffett, you can answer it on a simple question. And we've taken it one step further in our filters. First off is risk. If any one position were to go to zero, would they take me out on a stretcher? And that comes down to sizing and risk management. And the answer has to be no. And number two is, if we were to present an offer to the board of directors to purchase the entire company at the price that is quoted in the market, would they have us escorted out of the building? And if the answer is yes, then we are buying it at the right price. It should be insulting. They, you know, for most of the public prices that we're able to enter high quality businesses that are generating cash and growing and just temporarily impaired or temporarily out of favor, they would never consider selling it if we were to get financed to buy the whole company. And that's what creates the opportunity. And that's what Buffett is getting at here. And very few people think that way. They're more worried about bull flag breakouts and cup and handle nonsense, which is helpful if you're a short-term gambler, but useless if you want to make real money with real money over time by building a concentrated ownership position, not trading position, and then waiting for the market to realize that full value over time as the business inflects, and then as it re-rates, and then as it overrates, and then as euphoria kicks in and you lay off in stages across all of those different stages. Moving along. This is high yield credit spreads, which are tight and creating an environment for positive things to happen again in risk assets. We got the beautiful sell-off that we were calling for. That now looks like, with credit spreads tightening, you saw credit spreads blow out a little bit, getting people worried. Now the TLT is going up, yields are going down, everything is set up perfectly. And this chart is a nice illustration of that environment. I thought this was interesting from Charlie Gasparino over at Fox Business. He's talking about at the Milken Institute, there was a lot of scuttlebutt about getting Buffett to make an investment in Boeing to begin its corporate healing process. I wouldn't think about that, but I do think that is a kind of business that Buffett would be very interested in because, number one, the valuation is extremely attractive. Number two, he can put a lot of money to work. Number three, it's an oligopoly, and he likes to be in, you know, he likes the railroads, he likes the utilities because he has no competition. So that could be interesting. It is unlike being in the airline business. It's kind of selling the weapon. It's kind of being the arms dealer. The different airlines eventually cut each other to death and have bankruptcies every few years with pricing wars, whereas the supplier just gets to benefit by selling them the arms to kill each other, which is creating excess capacity with new planes. So I think it's interesting. I think what is probably holding him back in the short term, or he needs to get more clarity on, is he doesn't want to be put on the stand endorsing reckless management. I think what he's going to want to see is a new high quality CEO announced, reputable, high integrity CEO announced. And then if in fact that is in his on his radar, put money to work on that basis, you know, basically saying we disapprove of what had happened in the past. We fully believe in new management and the quality of an all-American company in Boeing. I don't know whether that'll happen or not. I thought that was a good scoop. And by the way, the most interesting thing about Boeing this week is the headlines couldn't be worse and the stock is going up. And that's usually a sign that a short-term bottom is in. Not a guarantee, but usually a sign. Okay, back to China, my favorite subject. This is from Macro Charts. It's talking about short interest in the China ETF. And what he's saying is when China shorts are all in, it's the beginning of a bull market. We agree. They just got to all in on that last final shoulder or double bottom, however you want to think about it, both in the FXI and the Hang Seng, et cetera. And that points to very good things moving forward. We agree. Then Sentiment Trader was out talking about over the past 10 days, more than three stocks advanced for every one that declined. Every time that's happened since 1997, it ended a bear market. We couldn't agree more. And we are positioned accordingly and smiling so wide we could eat a banana sideways as to what's to come. So exciting stuff there. Then Bar Chart was out with this golden cross, 50 crosses the 200. You know, it's all, it is what it is. Okay, now on to U.S. seasonality from Bank of America. In the election year, the seasonality for the year four of the presidential cycle, which we're in, as you can see, the March through May period when we were positioned with our hedges tends to be the weakest period of the year. And then you start to regain strength April to June, with May through July being very strong and June through August having a summer rally. So the trends are pointing up. Earnings are supportive of that. We got the correction out of the way to shake out the Johnny-come-latelys and the froth. And that was a pretty big correction in semiconductors of 17-18%. And then it went back and retested it as we had anticipated. And that's when we were able to flush out. And so into that, then you'll get some, looks like a little bit of volatility into the election and then a year-end rally. So this is a perfect roadmap. Doesn't mean it's guaranteed to happen, but it's just saying that's that. Here's the story about Warren Buffett looking for an investment in Canada for all my Canadian friends who sent me that beautiful Canada jersey and all, keep sending me these mining stocks. The Canadians love their commodities, let's just put it that way, and they're going to love their loony really, really soon. They're going to be coming down here and buying real estate and feeling like rock stars in another year or two. So a rising yen is good for stocks. Here's why. We've covered that a million times on the podcast. China's stock market has staged a big rebound that's poised to push on, strategist says. So they're looking at extreme sentiment, contrarian signals, has bounced back with a solid 20% surge from its bear market lows. That's the MSCI China. Roughly one third of constituents reached new 4-week highs last week, while close to 50% are also above their 200-day moving average, making the highest percentage reading since August. Another momentum gauge, the PPO, recently flashed a buy signal, adding more weight to the claim that the rally can push higher. Foreign investors are returning, putting money back to work in the country's markets. And then you also have the free option, which he doesn't mention here, is if the Stock Connect gets activated and then Chinese can start to buy Hong Kong stocks, which could be a huge, huge source of buying, which the government would be smart to do because that will reduce their necessity to be buying stocks in the open market and copying the Bank of Japan. They can just have their people do it, which would be a positive thing for everyone and improve sentiment and enable them to do what they want to do without having to do as much stimulus as they may plan on it. So China's Ant doubles down on global expansion with cross-border payments offering Alipay Plus. So all that stuff continues to build in the background. And then this one is on Disney. Bank of America securities analyst reiterated, for those of you who pay attention, Disney was down big after earnings because their streaming guidance wasn't as optimistic as everyone wanted, and the parks wasn't as optimistic. So now people are making up this narrative about the consumer. And maybe there'll be some short-term softness. Maybe there won't. I like the note that the Bank of America put out. Disney has a collection of best-in-class premier assets in content, intellectual property, as well as theme parks. That's been our thesis from the 80s. And near-term catalysts include, number one, additional updates on strategic priorities for Disney. And number two, inflection in profitability in direct-to-consumer. We think the stock price reaction today is as much about the tough comp comparison against Q1 of last year, something for everyone to report, as it is about reported results, et cetera, et cetera. So again, this is Disney. Young man knows the rules, old man knows the exceptions. And the exception here is that it's Disney. There is no comparison. Yes, Universal Parks are getting better. But I think as you see linear TV continuing to slide, as we saw with Warner Brothers Discovery today, and streaming build, there's only a few major players in streaming. They're also doing a bundle with Warner Brothers Discovery. So I think good things are happening here. This is the same as the transition in the early 80s when they went to VHS and they got to sell all of their great content library all over again. They're doing the same playbook with streaming, and people will buy it for their kids because you just don't know what your kids are watching on YouTube, but you do know what they're watching when you get Disney, particularly the classic stuff. Maybe the new stuff is not as exciting as everyone would like, but I think Iger got the message and is cleaning that up. Moving along, China rally hasn't been chased by options trader, Bank of America says, which gives, in their view, gives it a lot of room to run. Buying call options as such. Okay, there's not been a strong demand for buying call options as such. Chances are that the rally has further room to run from here, barring any nasty headlines or negative surprises out of China. I would say including that, because I think people are numb to the headline. We've been getting bad headlines every day for 2 years. So bad headlines, I think at this stage, is it's going to climb the wall of worry. Regional bank stocks are hated again. It's time to buy. This is from Jacob Sonenshine over at Barron's. We agree. We continue to own that basket. Hong Kong's new home sales hit record high of $5.4 billion. So that's not a headline you would expect to see out of China. Chinese stocks hit 2024 highs on more property support, positive trade data. So again, what was always negative, now you're starting to see some positives. European stocks set fresh record. FTSE 100 gains on Bank of England signals. The UK trade, which we have expressed through GXO Logistics, which reported earnings, revenues up 6%, and the stock was higher today. Very excited on that front. China's imports jump 8.4% in April, exceeding expectations as purchases from the U.S. grow. Bank of Japan's policy board becoming more concerned about effects of a weaker yen, which we covered. A couple charts I want to go through on natural gas. These are from macroops.com. And this is Henry Hub Natural Gas Futures, the July contract. He's pointing to a technical squeeze when these Bollinger Bands get very narrow and then it breaks out. I don't pay much attention to that, but I do like his valuation oscillator here. You can see when it gets to this extreme level, i.e. zero, here, 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 and now here, that tends to be the bottom and precede major secular moves in and rallies in natural gas, which we have expressed through a nice position in Comstock Resources. Here is the natural gas spot price and time spread also for macro ops. And you can see at these extreme levels is when you get bottoms followed by rallies. And we are at a super extreme here, which we think is also going to reflect a rally, probably along the lines of what we saw in the early 2000s, which is not on this chart. Here's GXO Logistics. Q1 revenue increased by 6% for $2.6 billion. You know, the logistics is in a slump, which is why we got an opportunity to buy such a great company at such a low price. But the fact that these guys can outperform being one of the biggest is a positive thing, and they're going to be able to buy up a lot more of these small people that are sucking wind and ride the next cycle up. So we love that. We think no one's better than Brad Jacobs and his acolytes in terms of executing on roll-up acquisitions and integration and not doing dumb deals, buying right, buying accretive. And this is already reflected. And they've got 50%, I think we covered this 2 weeks ago, of their revenue out of the UK, which we love as a currency trade. We love as a UK recovery trade. And we love because it's a Brad Jacobs company. So moving right along, GDP now is at 4.2% for the second quarter as of right now. So that's boding well. We're going to talk about earnings in a bit. Generac, just wanted to touch on a couple of things. Thanks to my buddy over at Stiefel. Basically, this guy is putting out a buy with a very, he's trying to be conservative with a low 145 price target. But again, you know, we were pounding the table on this thing below 100. It's recovering aggressively, and it's just the beginning of the cycle because, so they say here, field inventory falls, shipments and activations were aligned exiting 1Q 2024, indicating field inventory is reaching more normalized levels. The 2023 drag from excess field inventory is abating and supports our expectation for strong year-on-year growth in home standby generator sales in the coming quarters. That's been the core of our thesis, and now it's playing out. Company reiterated net sales growth of 3-7% in 2024. By the way, margins are accelerating in line with what management had said would happen, which is pretty exciting. Second half 2024 adjusted EBITDA margin is expected to be 450 basis points higher than the first half, driven by gross margin expansion, operating leverage. Remember, operating leverage is a theme in our portfolio. Coming out of the trough as it relates to the inventory cycle, the manufacturing recession ending, and onshoring, and all the key themes that happen in a nice cyclical recovery. Previous guidance was 600 basis points increase as margin improvements in first half came through sooner than anticipated. We believe this de-risks the guidance. We agree. And largely unchanged. Okay, buy rating. Generac to execute. Okay, while they're adjusted net income to free cash flow conversion of roughly 100% in 2024, while there were none in first quarter of 2024, which is great because the stock had run up a lot, we expect Generac to execute on its $500 million repurchase program as the year progresses. So we're excited for that. And then some notes from another friend out in California. Thank you for sending these over. It's basically a summary of all of the analysts after the earnings. The beat was driven by higher gross margin from better input cost mix and pricing. Inventory destocking is now in the rear view with February, March home standby generator shipments matching activations. This was our whole thesis from entry, and that's now happening and reflected in the price. commercial and industrial cyclicality could make current expectations conservative. So they had a really low guide on commercial and industrial for this year, and it's coming in better than anticipated. So that one was from Mark Strauss at JP Morgan. Now TD, Jeff Osborne, load growth from AI and data centers straining grids is a tailwind for Generac's natural gas backup systems. It's been part of our core thesis, margin, and also our natural gas thesis. Margin gains from inventories normalizing, ongoing telecom rental weakness partly offset by industrial distributor strength. So that's offset. Telecom did a lot of spend in previous years, which helped the company while the home standby generators were weak. And now the home standby generators are coming back, but the C&I is not as bad as thought because the industrial distributors are picking up strength. So clean energy business is now essentially a free call option at the current valuation. We talked about C&I strength. Residential and clean energy remain long-term growth drivers despite near-term challenges. Severe outage events could add material upside to estimates. You know, the other thing that Generac hasn't benefited from is a major hurricane. Even the minute you get that type of stuff happening, so I would just say if I was in the reinsurance business, I'd be concerned that I hadn't gotten hit hard in recent years, although some areas have. But if they get a hurricane, I mean, they could get a monster bump on the home standby generators. So we'll see. That's not in the guidance, but that could be a positive upside surprise from a company standpoint. You don't wish that for anyone, but they happen. So, and they're positioned to benefit if that does happen and help people out. So when it does happen in the future, they're not left high and dry. William Blair, free call option. We covered that. Northland Securities. Same thing, buybacks and hurricane season, 10% bottom line beat. And finally, UBS expects accelerating revenue growth in 2024. 1Q adjusted EBITDA plus 27% year on year and 11% above consensus on better gross margins. Gross margin now seen plus 300 to 350 basis points year on year, was plus 300 basis points. Destocking complete as shipment activations align. AI data center load growth straining grid reliability. So they have a secular tailwind behind them, and we got so lucky to buy the thing down 80 or 85% off of its COVID highs, and the game is just getting started. Are you mad or glad? Stock market and sentiment results. That's our article of the week, which focuses on Cooper Standard. So during earnings season, we try to cover one or two companies we've discussed in previous podcast videocasts. This week, Cooper Standard reported results. We originally initiated this position in May of 2022, around 550. You can see our original timestamped historic commentary in our note last quarter here, which references back all of our historic appearances about that stock. I was initially not happy with Cooper Standard's earnings results this quarter. I was specifically disappointed with the negative $31 million of free cash flow. But then I took the time to burden myself with the facts versus responding with emotion. And it turns out that Q1 is consistently a negative free cash flow quarter and has been the case even during the halcyon days when the stock traded to $146 per share. I've circled every first quarter free cash flow result in the chart below and added a table to illustrate the consistent trend. So you can see here, 2011, first quarter, negative free cash flow, 12, negative free cash flow, 13, negative free cash flow, 14, negative free cash flow, 15, negative free cash flow, 16. Okay, so you get the point. The point is that 17 out of 17 first quarter results, 16 of them had negative free cash flow. And in all cases where the stock was trading above $100 a share, the negative free cash flow was greater than the negative free cash flow in Q1 2024. Now, so you can see here, even when the stock got over $60. So in 2016, Let's see here. So 2014, the negative free cash flow for first quarter was negative $59 million. The next year, negative $60 million. The next year, negative $27 million. The next year, negative $54 million. The next year, negative $78 million. And that's when the stock was at $140-something. 2019, negative $61 million, et cetera. The only positive first quarter free cash flow was last year at plus $1.1 million. That was an aberration, not a trend. And this year was negative 31. So this is a very seasonal, as we had a strong free cash flow quarter in Q4, as they historically do every Q4. And I think that will continue. The other thing which we'll cover is that the subsequent quarters tend to inflect. So now, I am not saying that to get back to a multi-bagger status from here, the key is for them to generate negative free cash flow every Q1 moving forward. I'm not saying that's the secret to success. I'm just saying they've had tremendous success while doing that because of the seasonality of the business. I'm saying it appears to be a cyclical phenomenon since inception for this part of the year, with a tendency to improve in the following three quarters. Now that we see what went wrong, let's take a look at what went right. So first and foremost, Cooper Standard reports continuing year-over-year margin improvement in the first quarter of 2024, sees upside to full-year guidance. If you remember, last quarter I said he's guiding too conservatively. Well, he confirmed that, and one of the shrewd analysts in the Q&A got him to leak a quarter early what he thinks the guidance is going to be. And when I tell you, I think you're all going to be very happy. So got my amazing hedge fund tips mug from my buddies down in Dallas. Thank you very much. All right. Now, so first and foremost, gross profit totaled $61.6 million, an increase of 47.4% compared to first quarter of 2023. Operating income, positive $3.5 million, reflected an increase of $17.9 million versus first quarter of 2023. Net loss of $31.7 million, reflecting an improvement of $98.7 million versus the first quarter of 2023. Now, they did pay $86 million to Goldman Sachs. So if you back that out, they're still up big. We'll cover that as we get into the nuance on the call. Adjusted EBITDA increase of $16.9 million versus the first quarter of 2023. So Jeff Edwards here is saying, we expect to aggressively pursue further cost structure optimization, leverage commercial opportunities to accelerate growth and enhance value creation. Successful implementation of these initiatives is expected to have meaningful additional margin expansion and should represent upside to our original full year guidance, assuming industry production volumes hold. So as we covered last quarter, historically the IHS industry estimates have been too conservative. Their guidance, which is now going up, assumes flat volume growth. In other words, they're going to outperform the flat industry volume growth by taking market share. And if, God forbid, they actually do get industry volume growth, which last year they got 3 million cars more than anticipated. I'm cuffing that number, but I think that's correct. You can go back and view the note from last quarter, but it was meaningfully higher than was anticipated at the beginning of the year. Then you look at numbers that are not imaginable by even the upgraded guidance. So it's all about volumes, as you'll see here. You can click here to see that article where we went into the detail on that. Okay. So you can see the difference here in terms of adjusted EBITDA, 29.3 versus 12.5. Now, the year-over-year change in first quarter sales. So when I originally saw the negative sales, that was annoying as well. It's primarily attributable to the divestiture of their technical rubber business, and that's Europe-based, in the third quarter of 2023, and unfavorable foreign exchange. There were This was partially offset by favorable volume and mix, including sustainable price adjustment. So that technical rubber business was a money-losing business. So we gave up a few dollars in revenue in exchange for much greater profitability and margins. And in my book, that's the name of the game. So that's why that happened. It's not like the core business declined. The core business actually increased. The loser businesses that they got rid of, that's reflected in the top line. So that made a lot more sense. Adjusted EBITDA for the quarter was 29.3 versus 12.5. Volume mix, we covered that. New business awards. The company received net new business awards totaling $66.2 million in anticipated future annualized sales. That's a big deal. That include $34 million of net new business awards on hybrid vehicle platforms and $19.1 million of net new business on battery electric vehicles. Okay, so here you can see the core businesses, which are the sealing systems business, was up $3 million for the quarter, or $2.3 million from $348 to $351. And the fluid handling systems business was up from $300 million to $305 on flat volume growth, or no volume growth. And then the discontinued is where you see the hit. So the core businesses that are, you know, Prospective Co. moving forward were up. The money-losing business that they divested is what is took the revenues down. Then you have the EBITDA for these segments is just off the charts. Sealing systems was up $9.6 million. Fluid handling systems was up $6.7 million. And the business that they are divesting lost $500,000 less than they lost last year, which they lost $3.4 million last year. They lost $3 million this year. Good riddance. Goodbye. Sayonara. Cash and liquidity at the end of the quarter, $281 million, including I think it's $114 in cash and $180 or something. We'll go through that on the ABL. They got an extension on the ABL line to 2029. So they've got that $280 million and change of liquidity all the way to 2029. We probably won't even own this thing, but maybe 2029, probably not. It probably will have done what we needed to do much sooner than that. And the other thing is, the other thing that's great about it is not only do they have the liquidity, but they're also guiding free cash flow positive for the year, which is in line with what we said. The first quarter, every 16 out of the last 17 years, is where they have negative free cash flow due to the seasonality. And then the subsequent three quarters is where they make it back and then some. And on their conservative initial guidance of free cash flow positive, which they're now going to take up, plus having the ample liquidity, puts them in a great position to refinance everything next year, which we're going to talk about and they emphasize on the earnings call. So industry estimates, IHS estimates for global light vehicle production is flat. They had a similar thing last year and it was up meaningfully more than they thought. So if that's the case and their new increased guidance doesn't even include that, the impact could be significant for a business with this amount of operating leverage. So efficiency and improvement through additional lean cost structure initiatives drive meaningful additional margin expansion that should represent upside to the company's original full year guidance. So you can see here their gross margin went from 6.1 to 9.1, EBITDA margin from 1.8 to 4.3. And their CapEx went down from 4.3 to 2.5. So that's good to see. Here's their liquidity of 281, 114 cash, 167 ABL availability now pushed out to 2029. That is positive to see. The strategic growth drivers are predominantly expanded cost per vehicle because with hybrids, which is the new trend, EVs have more parts than ICEs for Cooper Standard, but hybrids have even more than EVs, and hybrid seems to be the new trend, so they're going to benefit handily from that, as well as they believe they can build fluid brake system, build fluid systems business in China, which has been not an area of focus in the past. So that's positive to see. They're going to do cost savings of 20 to 25 million in 2024 through headcount reduction, and finalized cost savings of 40 to 45 million expected in 2025. Payback of restructuring costs in approximately 6 months. That is huge for them to be cash flow positive on that restructuring, which is good. Now, on to the earnings call. A couple highlights here. Another solid quarter with our, this is from Jeff Edwards, with our manufacturing and purchasing teams delivering $19 million of savings through lean initiatives and other cost saving programs. This improved efficiency combined with our enhanced commercial agreements enabled us to improve our gross profit margin by a solid 300 basis points. They got $66 million of net new business awards. They became supplier of the year for General Motors. That's a big, big deal. Now, as it relates to the sales, which I touched on, a slight decrease of 90 basis points compared to the first quarter of 2023. Quote, the decrease was driven primarily by the divestiture of our technical rubber business in Europe during the third quarter of last year and a smaller divestiture of our stake in a joint venture in Asia. Excluding the impact of these divestitures, which represented $13 million of sales in the first quarter of 2023, net sales for the first quarter of last year would have been $669 million. On that basis, our sales for the first quarter of 2024 would have been up 1% year over year, outpacing global automotive production growth. Gross profit for the first quarter was $61.6 million, or 9.1% of sales. This compares with gross profit of $41.8 million, or 6.1% of sales in the first quarter of 2023. So if I can get, I'll give up $13 million of revenue every day of the week if I'm also giving up $3 million a year of losses, which is exactly what they did, which is fantastic. Adjusted EBITDA in the quarter was 29.3 compared to 12.5. Favorable volume mix, enhanced commercial and lean savings. Okay. Net loss was 31.7 compared to a net loss of 130.4 million. Again, that seasonality. Okay. We continue to have discipline around capital investments, which remain primarily focused on customer launch readiness and maximizing returns on invested capital. Revenue favorable volume and mix, including net customer price adjustments, increased sales by $8 million versus the first quarter of 2023. Covered that. For EBITDA, lean initiatives in purchasing and manufacturing contributed $19 million year over year. That's huge. Favorable volume and mix, net price adjustments, as well as other cost recoveries, drove a combined $15 million of profit improvement. And material cost improvements were a further benefit of $1 million. The liquidity we covered, $282 million. Signed an extension of our ABL through May of 2029. That's a big deal, actually. Continue executing on our plans to enhance value over the long term. Based on our current outlook and expectations for light vehicle production, are improving margin, operating efficiency, further cost reduction initiatives, and the continuing benefit from enhanced commercial agreements with our customers, we expect to generate positive free cash flow for the full year. So that is not on increased guidance. That's their base case. And then we get the increased guidance at the end of Q2 like they do every year. And God forbid the industry volume actually increases, they're going to have gains, not just from taking more share, by being leaner, meaner, and having better technology and innovation, but by getting the benefit of the numbers. And based on that outlook, our current total liquidity position, we believe we have sufficient resources to execute the business and pursue our growth objectives for the foreseeable future. Okay, so that was John Banas. And then now it's back to Jeffrey Edwards, the CEO. The next few minutes, I'd like to provide you some insights into our change in operational management structure from a regional basis to a product line basis and how this change fits in the overall strategy and will drive some significant cost improvements in our business, accelerate growth, and maximize the long-term value of our company. Product-based management is intended to do just that. establishing complete P&L ownership and accountability for each product line, optimizing allocation of human and capital resources, streamlining operations and engineering execution, and enabling us to more quickly deliver value-add innovation to our customer, working from a position of strength as a global leader in the market. We'll expand our market share and competitive advantage through technology and customer service, enhancing our customer relationships, as well as pursuing opportunistic market opportunities in support of our customers. We expect to improve profitability and return on asset by right-sizing costs within our operations while aligning capital investments with high growth opportunities, benefiting from hybrid and electric vehicles, significantly increase our average content per vehicle, as well as expand our total addressable market. Patented innovations will also improve our competitive advantage and enable market share gains. We believe we can be competitive and build solid fluid handling business in China, which historically they've been speaking down about. Now they're speaking up about, based on proprietary technology enhancements we provide to electric vehicles. As automotive production levels have not rebounded as quickly as many had expected, it's certainly imperative that we do so. Further optimize costs by eliminating redundancies, automating processes, and leveraging technology. Beginning later this quarter, we'll be implementing a plan to reduce salaried workforce globally, which we covered. The actions are expected to save between 20 to 25 million in 2024 and between 40 and 45 million on a full year annualized basis next year. Anticipated savings are expected to provide payback on related restructuring costs in 6 months. Further, we expect savings will enable both operating segments to approach, if not achieve, double-digit EBITDA margins as we expect as we exit 2025. And by the way, he adds in the Q&A, and double-digit return on invested capital. As these initiatives were not contemplated when we developed our initial plan for the year, successful implementation and the related cost savings could represent an upside to our 2024 full year guidance, certainly assuming industry production volumes hold at planned levels. What if they go up? Which could be the case if you start, if you see one or two cuts as well. So second quarter, very quick payback period, dramatically reduce our costs, make ourselves more agile, make our decision-making what it needs to be, support our customers, and frankly, move a lot closer to the double-digit EBITDA and double-digit return on invested capital objectives that we have to point that we will be there next year with those particular objectives. And certainly as we exit 2025, that's what we believe. So double-digit EBITDA margins, double-digit return on invested capital by 2025 at the latest, the 2025 exit, which is right on track with what they've been saying the entire time. Now, here's Mike Ward asked this question. Yes, I got you. So given your current year initial guidance of EBITDA of 180 to 210, if you remember, I said that was conservative. Now, if all things being equal, we could be looking at somewhere in the 200 to 235 range. Is that what you're saying when you get this thing done this year? Mike Ward asked Jeffrey Edwards, and Jeffrey says, yes, we'll describe to you like we always do when we exit Q2. And Mike Ward says in Q2, and then Jeffrey Edwards takes the bait and he says, but yes, your range would be accurate as we sit here today. I guess the biggest issue that everybody has, we're not there, the Lone Ranger here, obviously, what are the volumes going to be? I mean, if I knew that, then I can answer your question. So Michael Ward says, it looks like you're looking at a $25 million charge and that'll be cash costs as well, but pretty quick payback. Yes, actually, from a cash point of view, it will be a cash flow positive even for 2024. And then Mike Ward talks about the industry push for hybrids. And Jeffrey Edwards says, yes, good question. So if we use ICE as the baseline to your question, and if we would go from ICE vehicle to a hybrid vehicle, meaning our customers would, and then we would be supplying the fluid handling for that particular hybrid, it almost doubles our content per vehicle. Mike Ward says, so hybrids two times of ICE internal combustion, and then electric vehicles even higher than that. We actually, EV would be about 20 to 30% higher is the number we've used in the past, whereas hybrids are double. So hybrids are even better. Okay, higher relative to ICE or you deal with hybrid then. Relative to ICE. So hybrid is definitely the higher content per vehicle solution for Cooper Standard. And as everyone knows, the whole narrative has shifted from all EV to now hybrid for everyone. Consumers want them, dealers want them, everyone wants them. And that's the best possible outcome for Cooper Standard. And my whole base case has always been off ICE, which is the lowest content per vehicle. So this all represents new upside. Are you still using the same production estimate and volumes we talked about are unchanged? We saw some recovery. Okay, so as you know, the first quarter was a bit challenging as it got started from a volume point of view, but then we saw some recovery in February and March. Was, I guess, what we were hoping March would be, is how I would describe it. So a little bit slow start, but a strong March helped the overall number. That's good information. And then Kirk Ludke asked, were you EBITDA positive in all regions again this quarter? And Jeff Edwards said yes. If you remember, in 2022, like, basically the U.S. was the only thing making any money. Or trying to make any money at that point. Now they are. Okay. But we haven't seen a whole lot of our core business cannibalized, if I could say it that way. So that's good. And as we've been told by our customers, certain EVs are being pushed out as much as 2 years on some new business that we already have been awarded. That wasn't a significant hit to us just because we hadn't spent a bunch of money on it. And so we're just on hold there. And in the meantime, we'll continue to run what we already run longer. So it's probably going to be a bit of a benefit too from an asset point of view. So I guess there's puts and takes, but I'm not complaining. So he's basically saying, yeah, if the EVs are pushed out, we're happy to run the ICE and the hybrids. That's a better setup for us, less investment. Okay. When you compare apples to apples and you look at the industry automotive versus our automotive revenue, we were actually up for the quarter slightly. That is what we think is going to continue to be like. And we still expect to outgrow the markets that we serve in automotive. I think that's the key point. What they're saying there is we're taking share. Saying with the announcement here around the sealing and fluid handling going forward, the innovation we have given customers excitement about it, and what I just talked about previous caller in terms of content per vehicle going up, especially our fluid business, we expect to continue to gain share. Ben Briggs asked, do you guys see gross margin hitting double digits, call 10% plus during the current fiscal year, or is that something we should think about 2025? This is Jeff. The answer is yes. And I was pretty clear about what I think 2025 is going to be. So we should be back to double digit EBITDA and ROIC as a company as we exit 2025. John Bannis, so that's that. Okay, that's okay. Fair enough. So then Brian DeRubio asked if they're planning on doing a global refi, meaning refinance all their debt at lower rates next year. And Jonathan Bannis says that's our current thinking. Of course, that all depends on the production environment, interest rate environment, all alike. But certainly with our trajectory, we're thinking about it in terms of continued improvements in the cost base of the business, improvements in the free cash flow that Jeff and I have been talking about here today. We think that sets up very well to be in the market next year, but a lot of factors go into that. Obviously what Powell does, et cetera. That's my addition there. You talked about the impact. You can see the impact that's had. Obviously our bullish comments today about what we think 2020. Okay. Inflation pressures. We feel like we've done a really good job. Our customers have certainly stood up and supported Cooper Standard's request. He's talking about pricing now. Talked about the impact at the end of last year. You can see that impact, and that's had during the first quarter. Obviously, our bullish comments today about what we think 2024 could be and certainly 2025. But I think we're in a good position to be successful. Type of cash we need to be generating, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the call. So it's interesting. You look at the headline, revenues down, negative free cash flow, all bad news. When you step back, they got rid of $3 million of losses. They improved their margins across the board on flat industry volume. They actually picked up sales, picked up margin, picked up profitability. And in the scheme of Q1s going back 17 years, it was one of their better ones. So all of that is very, very positive, and we took advantage of that. So here's sentiment. Bullish percent was improving. Bearish dropped down to 23. So retail investors are getting confident again, but you can see here there could be a long way to run before they get too exuberant. And that kind of sets us up into this summer rally. Maybe we have a little more bumps in May, but more likely than not, we're going to be up a few months out and maybe materially. And that's that. National Association of Active Investment Managers. Let's just see what they did today, because that comes out in Thursday afternoons. My guess is they're a bit up. Yeah, they shot from 60 to 90%. So that's that. Earnings is interesting. Retail top 30 weights of the sector ETF. Cumulative earnings power estimates over the last 60 days have actually come down just 11 basis points for 2024, but down 2.14% for next year. So we'll have to see if that was skewed. Looks like by any one company. No, it looks pretty consistent. So that's to keep an eye on. Transports and earnings estimates revision also came down 4.62 for this year and 3.35 for next year. Uber was taken down. UPS was taken down a bit. A lot of the trucking companies are a little bit getting hit. Old Dominion Freight Line. That's cyclical. They'll come back. It's also part of why we were able to buy GXO at such an incredible price. Yeah, you can't give away some of these truckers and transport companies right now. And that's going to be where some ArcBest, they're all getting smashed. RXO, there's some ponies in this pile. We've picked one of those ponies up and we'll look for more things to do. Economic data. I thought today was interesting from the standpoint of initial jobless claims coming in higher than expected. That is what the Fed needs to see to do that first cut, is some weakness in the labor market. So we'll see if we get any follow through on that. Earnings have been good. They came in, remember, they took estimates way down. Well, they beat blended year-over-year earnings growth is plus 5%. They had taken it down to 3.2%. And so they're beating, and that's why you're seeing the stock market doing well. The other thing of important note is that earnings estimates cumulatively are coming back, or collectively are coming back up. You can see the chart we look at every week from FactSet is it's gone from like 242 back up to almost 244. And for next year at 277. So we troughed a little bit in early April, and now guidance is going up. And that's why the stock market is starting to follow it as well. So all of those things are good. So the podcast is over, but we're going to do the Ask Me Anything question. For those of you who want to stick around, these are questions from our audience. We got quite a few this week. And we are going to do the disclaimer. Okay, you can get it at hedgefundtips.com. Click on terms and you can just find it at the end. Or if you want to listen to our new jingle, you can find it at the end of the Ask Me Anything questions. Tim Schroyer, just curious, is VF Corp still on your conviction list? There's no change. We still own VF Corp. They report later this month. It's so interesting, by the way. It's like in Connecticut, I'm probably the only person that wears Vans. In California, everyone wears Vans. And what was so interesting about it was, you know, you think of Vans, you think of skateboarders. Like a lot of the parents at the water polo was wearing it, were wearing it. And that's kind of like a higher end kind of group. It's not skateboarders, that's for sure. And everyone at the airport and, you know, just all kinds of people. And what's cool is it was probably a 65-35% mix. 65% the classic style and 35% the new style. So there's probably some legs there. And those channel checks that we covered a few weeks back will probably be reflected in this week's call. I don't know if he can turn it this quick in Q1, but I'm not getting daily emails for discounts anymore. And the stores I visited seemed good, and the employees seemed to think things were good. But it, you know, it's a little early to expect miracles. The other thing that was interesting is everyone wears Dickies pants in California, which is also mind-boggling to me. That's another brand that they own. And then everyone knows North Face, of course. So let's see what Bracken Darrell can do. If he can have something positive to say in such a short period of time, that would be whipped cream. We're grateful to own a lot at and near these levels, and no change at all. Jacob Saxtoff, I'm not sure why there would even be a question about a change. There's been no new information for me to judge how the business is doing. So if you're asking me, did it come off my conviction list because it went down $2, then I've been an ineffective communicator in this videocast podcast in how we think about owning businesses. Something I'd have to have new information about how the business is operating for me to change my theses, not some fake narratives and garbage nonsense and price actions to inform my decision. What would inform my decision is numbers, okay, is really what it comes down to. Nothing more than numbers. Jacob Saxtoff, thanks for your podcast. Enjoy listening to the analysis and your take on the market all the way from Denmark. Well, welcome from Denmark. My question is, I currently evaluate Lumen Technologies to see if this is a good potential turnaround case. Can you say where potential turnaround, how would you analyze it? Well, that would take 4 weeks. Let me just see if it's worth doing any work on it. I think this is Lumen's value. Lumen Technologies. Okay, so here's a stock that's down from $20 down to $1. This is probably, before I even look at it, has a tremendous amount of debt and is probably going to go bankrupt and get restructured. This is looks like an Altice. I think this is Telecom, L-U-M-N. No, that's not what I want. I don't want this, L-U-M-N. Okay. Smaller. All right, financial analysis. First off, let's look at this. Okay. All right, so negative free cash flow, revenues declining. See on a quarterly basis if they're showing any sign. They're showing zero signs of turnaround. They're showing a secular decline, which is what the stock is showing. Balance sheet. First thing you do with a company like this is solvency risk. So they got $1.5 billion of cash. They've got $18 billion of debt. And negative $500 million of free cash flow. I don't need to even look any further. I'm a hard pass on that. That's probably going to be restructured and the debt holders are going to own the assets. Maybe they'll get lucky, but this looks like Frontier before the restructuring, and I'll take a pass. So that was easy. Thanks for asking, and welcome from Denmark. Joe Gualtieri. Have you taken a look at Oddity Tech? It's a beauty and wellness play. Let's take a look. ODD. Okay, so that's an IPO. I'm probably not going to have enough financial information for me to make a decision on it or even be interested in it. But I'll have a look. See, Lou. This is a tiny micro cap. It looks like growing revenues very, very aggressively. And what about share count? Share count's not bad. Let's see here. All right, so their revenues. Debt. All right, let's take a look at the financials. Covered balance sheet, $77 million of cash. No material debt. Free cash flow generation is good. Huh, what do these guys do? Builds digital first brands for the beauty and wellness industries in the US, serves consumers through its AI-driven online platform. I hate these tagline stuff. This reminds me of the Long Island Iced Tea Company getting into Bitcoin mining. Machine learning, computer vision capability, identify customer needs, develop solutions in form of beauty and wellness products. Incorporated in Tel Aviv, Israel. This is a tough thing because you got to know about consumer brands and hope that it's not a fad and understand. This is not the type of business I'd be interested in, but it definitely is worth doing the work on. I think you have, I'm just trying to see here. $2 billion market cap. $1.8 billion enterprise value, generates $100 million of free cash flow. I mean, it's worth exploring. For me, you're taking country risk, then company risk. So you just have to understand what they're selling, where they're selling it, and why it's durable. And for me, there's just not enough history for me to get excited about it. But I think your framework is correct, and you should explore it further and get on 8 or 9 conference calls. Look at the investor deck, start to see the competition. What makes them unique? How is their moat not going to be eroded? And if you can answer those questions, then you have a good starting point. Daniel D. Tom, under what circumstances would you consider shorting semiconductors again in the near future? It's done. I mean, we're going to rally into the summer. So, I mean, hypothetically, you can have some black swan in May to retest it, but I think we already did the retest that we were looking for. We had the flush, then we had the rally, and everyone got excited, then we retested, and that was it. So I wouldn't get too bearish on it. We took advantage of, we bought some Intel in, for those of you who've been around, you know, we bought Intel last year at 25 and change. We sold a bunch at 2/3 at 48 and change. It went up to 51 without us, and then it collapsed. So we still have the third of free money on. We added to that in the high 20s very, very recently, which we talked about our inclination to do so last week. Is the exact bottom in? We don't know. But at these levels, we like it because we think the legacy business is worth mid 40s. To low 50s, and then you got a free option on the foundries and the government money and the AI chips and all that stuff that Gelsinger thinks he can deliver on. I don't know if he can or he can't, but I know I've got a margin of safety because the legacy business is worth $45. And if this whole narrative around AI PCs turns out to be true, he's going to benefit greatly, which means we're going to benefit greatly. So we're taking that position back up where we can at these levels. Which ironically brings our basis up for that last third, but, you know, can't be pigs. So that's that. And as far as the overall SMH industry and like the high flyers like NVIDIA, I'm agnostic. I don't think I would get I mean, I don't, I'm really agnostic. I mean, the semiconductor index could be overhyped and continue to roll over huge. And I'd still feel comfortable owning Intel at these levels. I'm just agnostic on it. It's kind of like gold. I wouldn't want to be long or short at this point. We got a quick 17% pullback. We had some leverage on the position. It was a small amount that had asymmetry we benefited from. But we're not going to be pigs on this because there are some good things happening. You know, it's kind of like GLPs. It's like this may be a miracle drug, okay? And that doesn't mean there are not going to be huge amounts of procedures done by Baxter. But, you know, I look at Diageo, for instance, and I want to buy that stock all day long. And I think there's something to it. I mean, the good news is right now it's still a niche, you know, hundreds of thousands of subscriptions to the GLP-1s and mostly only wealthy people taking them. But the cost will come down and a lot of people will be on them. And if it doesn't kill people, it's going to make them a lot healthier, which seems to be the case. So the point is there's some aspect of it that's going to be hype and there's some aspect of it that's going to be true. The same as in AI. And that's why I just avoid things where I have to guess the future. And I bet on sure things that are, you know, cyclical and out of favor that I can play the recovery and get a quick double or triple. Or things that are durable over time and just temporarily out of favor. You know, as far as betting on the future things, I'll do that if it's a free option, but I'm not going to bet real money on predicting the future like a lot of people are doing, because even if you're right, sometimes you're paying so much for it that when it actually realizes, like Cisco hasn't made a new high in 26 years. So I think you're going to see a lot of that moving forward. So that was just a layup, the short-term move, and I wanted a way to express my short-term pessimism and to dampen volatility, which we did all of those things, and that was the place to do it. But as far as like pound the table short on any of that, that's not our knitting and not what we're focused on. Sagar Kanyakia, hope you're having a fantastic week. Can't wait for your next podcast Thursday. Thank you very much, Sagar. I know that you've been a great supporter for some time, and we're grateful for that. After going through the videos of a Berkshire annual meeting, hearing Buffett talk about he could guarantee a 50% return a year if he had capital of only $1 million by looking into smaller companies, I started going through a few names myself. I stumbled across FIMV, which provide loan services to borrowers, investment services, and preliminary credit assessment services to institutional funding partners, essentially acting as a middleman between the borrower and the funding partner, the bank. Companies generated the majority of its revenue in China, is growing internationally with Indonesia, Philippines, revenue at 17%. I know you have China plays both directly via Alibaba and indirectly via VF Corp. Was wondering, what are your thoughts on this company? I won't play any smaller mid-cap companies in China at all, because it's a coin flip if they're a fraud, and especially a financial company. I just won't do it. I looked at the numbers. It looks great. Your framework is correct. And I just won't do it because it could be a fraud. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, my bet with, I'm not going to take company and country risk. So my bet with Alibaba is if Alibaba were ever proven to be a fraud, China would be over. So meaning no foreign money would ever come into China. And they've been audited for 20 some odd years. You know, it gives me the highest propensity, and I got to buy it at a tremendously low price. And average down to build it a much lower basis. And so I like that risk reward, and I like that way to play the dollar emerging markets trend, China trend, all of that stuff I love. I don't want to take excess risk on top of that. And that's that. So I think you went about it right. I just wouldn't do it in China or many emerging markets for that matter. So Zhao James, because look, when emerging markets get oversold, you get to buy the best assets in the world at 80% off. You don't need to fumble around with, you know, mid-tier businesses when you get to buy the best ones at such a huge discount. Why play that game? That's what you do in the US when you can't find anything to do and you get to buy these high quality up-and-comers or cyclical turnarounds like Cooper Standard that have a long history that you can understand the business and you can count on the numbers. That's where you play that. You only play those games in America. You don't play those outside America. You're going to get your you know, tail hand it to you. Zhao James, what delta range do you select when buying options? I believe you only buy out of the money leaps. False. And that's exclusively for the benefit of our clients. What strikes and what duration that we buy and what Greeks we use. So leave it at that. On Daniel D, Tom, I wouldn't be would you be surprised if Nvidia tested $1,000 a share? Not only would I not be surprised, I would care less. So thank you for that. Jordan Smith, thoughts on Bristol Myers? I think this was from last week and I said it was fine. Nancy Martin, grateful for your podcast and willingness to share your wisdom. Wanted to ask about Oil States International, whether you think it's a good buy. It's down, seems to have cash, decent cash flow. The only servicer I really would feel comfortable buying is Schlumberger. Oil States has kind of been in the doghouse for a while. I think this thing sets up as a trade. I actually looked at it a few weeks ago and passed, so I'm not going to take a look at it here. I think you're probably okay. I just don't like any of them here. What I like is Comstock Resources. I'm going to play natural gas. We loved servicers and integrated in 2020. That was the time to buy it. Everyone started chasing it after they had all doubled and tripled. Not for us. So if we got a material pullback in servicers and or integrated, I'd take a new look. Right now, the only thing that's on sale that we're super interested in is Comstock Resources. Went down to 7 and change. Now it's back up to 10 and change. It's just getting started. This is going to be the next Range Resources, which, by the way, is at new highs again. So Nancy Martin, grateful. Okay, so we did that. Thank you, Nancy. This Tim Cowan asks, thanks for taking my AMA. I have a new one. What is your view on HRTG? So HRTG is down 22% on Q1 earnings. Well, it's also up 10x, and now you're interested in it after it's up 10x. So that's I just don't operate that way, but I'm going to take a look at it for you and see if there's some additional value that can be had, which may or may not be the case, but I'm just more interested when no one wants it. All right, let's have a look. Okay, so what did they do? Some big acquisition? Because the revenues jumped from 191 to 749, if this is accurate. Let's see. Free cash flow, $100 million. Profitability. All right, what kind of business is this? Insurance holdings, commercial, personal, and commercial residential insurance products. You really have to know what you're doing with this. You're going to have to study their balance sheet, which is going to be absolutely critical because remember, most of these guys had to buy a ton of long duration assets when they were yielding nothing and their portfolios got blown up. So that's number one. Number two, price hardening is probably never going to be as hard as it is right now, looking 10 years out. So I don't really want to be chasing this bandwagon, and this is a small provider. So as good as the numbers look, I'm going to pass on that because I think the time to buy PNC, let's just see the insurance ETF. Yeah, this thing's been straight up. Not for me. I'm going to pass. Even though the numbers look good, I understand why you're doing it, but you really have to know what's in their portfolio and what's upside down and if they have to raise capital. Okay, Patrick McKenzie. A relatively new listener to the podcast, can tell that my level of knowledge seems well below that of your general audience. I've been listening for a few months, and now I'd be lying if I admit 75% of what you say goes above my head. When you tell people to do research on the company, how can I learn what it is and what I should be looking for? Can I read through cash flow statements or listen to earnings call? But I really don't know what I'm supposed to try to catch. I understand you won't go through the basics of stock trading on your podcast, but do you have any suggestions of where I can learn to graduate an understanding of your pod a little better? Regardless, I genuinely appreciate your content and try to share it with any of my friends who might listen. Thank you, and go Flyers. Oh my God, Patrick. Go Devils. All right. Anyway, Patrick McKenzie, thanks for welcome to the fold. I would say number one is read Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor. That's Warren Buffett's number one recommendation. That's number one. If it clicks for you, you're going to know this is for you. Then from there, if you want to get into more depth, security analysis. Then from there, if you want to get into more depth, read the CFA books. From there, then you just have to read as many annual reports as humanly possible. I'd start just reading one a day, or if you're part-time, one a week. And just and listen to all the conference calls when you find a company that you like. And sooner or later, these things will start to mesh. And if you like it, enjoy the process. If you're trying to do it to get rich quick, save your time and just compound your money. You know, if you just put it in an index fund over, you know, you're basically going to double your money every 8 to 9 years. And that adds up over time, and you dollar cost average, you put in every month and you go play golf. So this is, you know, this takes a full-time commitment. So you really have to love it. And the way to filter out whether you're actually going to love it or not, read The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham. And if the light bulb goes off and you feel like your life has changed, then you'll do it 24 hours a day, and you're going to become extremely good at it after 5 or 10 years. And keep listening, and you'll learn stuff. You'll pick up stuff. You're educating yourself. It's just, you know, if it's for you, you're never going to feel like it's work. And if that's the case, you're going to do unbelievably well at it moving forward. So hang in there. I think you're on the right track. Annual reports, earnings calls, some sell side research won't kill you. Might not help you, but it won't kill you. And those books are key. Read those over and over again. And the Warren Buffett annual letters, you can get them all the way back to the 60s. That is a crash course that will save you years of going in the wrong direction. So those would be the shortcuts. Shortcuts would be read Buffett's annual letters after you read The Intelligent Investor. Michael Ozarek. Ozarek. Michael Ozarek. Could you give me your thoughts on Howard Hughes Holdings? This is a sum of the parts play and a bet on housing coming back. I would say you're probably fine here. Problem with it is that you don't know when you're going to get the sum of the parts. So like those St. Joe's people, these guys had all their money in St. Joe's because it was going to be the biggest Florida development. And it's happening. The problem is they lost all their assets under management waiting for it to happen over 15 years. And it still hasn't been like huge. I'll just show you St. Joe. Yeah, so they were all like huge on this in 08 and 09. So it went from 36 to 12. So they were down like 66% after 10 years. And now they got back up to their basis in 2021 after 10 years. They earned their money back, the ones that were alive, but most of them got redeemed. And now it's a double after 10 years. So their IRR is shit. It doesn't mean that it won't go a lot higher. I think it will. I think Howard Hughes is probably a better high quality play. But you know, you're betting on development and land realization, and you have no control over the outcome or the timing. It's probably a better place to park your money than T-bills, but it's not what we do. We want free cash flowing, cash generative things. But I think with this sell down, because of rates being high, rates are going to get lower, the demand is there. I think you could have a home run. I know Howard Hughes has a ton of Summerland land, and you look at all the 30-year-olds and the millennials, you probably wind up with a double over a handful of years. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So I like how you're looking. It's just not something, there are higher and better uses, but I think you'll win with that. Mitch Lim, what do you think about Caro? 20, 20, K-A-R-O. Never heard of it, but let's have a look. Okay. Software as a service in South America. Okay, so I'm taking company and country risk. These numbers better be damn good, Mitch. Let's see. So again, they must have done a big acquisition, so everyone's excited. Cash flow positive, balance sheet. Pretty clean. Yeah, I just, you know, the problem with these SaaS companies, especially the small ones, just tell me why they're not going to get competed away. And if you can be certain about that, then you should pursue doing a proper analysis of it. But credit management for asset-based vehicle finance, like, this is like hairy stuff, because if their economy turns a little bit south, they get roasted. If they're doing, you know, they're probably doing the subprime stuff, kind of like a PAGS in Brazil. And, you know, they're hairy businesses and they're down for a reason. Doesn't mean you won't get a monster run out of it, but I'd probably pass. Let's see, Joseph Vecchio. Hold on for a second. Okay, Joseph Vecchiola. Asked me, do you remain bullish on VF Corp, CCI, and BABA? As bullish as ever. And by the way, CCI is an unbelievable opportunity down here, and that was just down on rates. BABA's moved up a lot, you know, from 68 to 80 in a couple of weeks. They report mid-month, but that's just getting going. And then VF Corp reports mid-month. We've covered that. No change because nothing's changed. So if you're asking me if I'm still bullish because the price went up $12 or down $1, that doesn't even factor into my analysis. Xavier Smith, great content. Thanks for the great content every week. Just want to get your opinion on the fact that BABA is underperforming the Hang Seng while PDD is up. Look, what's your opinion and reason for that? Number one, it's not underperforming the Hang Seng by much. Number two, we're awaiting information to see how they performed in the last quarter. So there's no new catalyst. And as far as PDD goes, we've covered that in past podcasts. And the key there is that either their numbers are unsustainable or unreliable. I'm not sure which one, but we covered the Financial Times article, and usually where there's that level of smoke, there's probably some fire. At the end of the day, when the country was in a depressive vortex, groups like Temu selling trinkets and low-cost stuff are going to benefit. When the economy begins to recover, as we saw 5.3% GDP print, people move back up the scale to higher end stuff where Taobao and Tmall dominate, and dominate in mindshare and dominate in offerings. So you know, PDD, assuming legitimacy or full legitimacy, is going to benefit from the rearview mirror environment. BABA is going to benefit from the windshield environment looking out to the future. We don't get distracted by that. Alibaba, we're in because of the margin of safety and because of the outs. We've got the cloud, we've got the supermarket business, we've got the delivery business, we've got a third ownership of Ant Financial, we've got the best retail platform, and we've got international growth, and we've got the biggest opportunity in the private sector for compute power demand, AI app sales, and the continued digitization of China, which is at least 5 years behind the United States. So basic cloud services, compute power for AI, which is why they've cut prices and they're going to lock everyone into their ecosystem and then sell them apps for the next 10 years and AI applications, which they're already doing. So I think this is the Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare. We're happy to be the tortoise because ultimately the tortoise wins the race as the hares get burned out. Jordan V, why do people even bother looking at net income if free cash flow is the most important number and it isn't easily manipulated? Why doesn't more of the financial media quote free cash flow per share? Because most of the financial media is a bunch of salespeople and they don't do proper analysis and they're more concerned with the price action over the next 2 minutes than over the next 2 to 4 years, which is where real money is made. So that's the bad news. The good news is you don't have to participate. You get to sit back and buy high quality when it's on sale and consistently compound and multiply your money and not get distracted by trading and eventually blowing up or delivering non-ideal outcomes and getting caught in some of these high flyers that collapse and then getting caught in with leverage and margin like many of these players do. And you don't hear from them and they're not, you know, they're not durable. They come and they go and it's just it's a merry-go-round on Wall Street. So my suggestion is if you want longevity and you want to build something great, use time-proven principles and stay away from the shiny objects. Nick Foster, or do them in extreme moderation where there's asymmetry. Thoughts on Greenbrick, GRBK. I like that people are coming to me with housing because it's like taking a little bit of a hit with the high interest rates in the short term. BK. Okay, so you're giving me a stock that's up 30x. And it could double again, but it's not where I like to enter. I think it's going to be fine. I just don't think you're going to get any real outperformance after the move that it's already had. I mean, yes, it's still growing. Yes, you're going to get hockey stick demand, but I think that you're not going to get another 30x. That's for damn sure. Let's take a look here. It's a big Einhorn holding, but he's had it. You know, this has carried his performance for years and years and years, and he has such a high concentration in it. And for years, he underperformed partially because of it. But now he's getting the payoff because he's a man of his conviction. And it works over time. He knows in the short term, the market's a voting machine. In the long term, it's a weighing machine. And this one has proven out. But he's probably closer to harvesting. He was planting years ago. And people are now coming on board. And the people that come on board late, he'll be harvesting too. I'm not saying he's harvesting anytime immediately soon, but I think he would be more thinking about when he's getting out than how much more he can add at $60 after it was at $250. Cash from free cash flow positive, balance sheet, $41 million of cash, balance sheet's clean. I mean, it's fine, but I could probably find better home builders to take advantage of. You know, the problem with home building, though, is that it really hasn't come down enough yet, given where rates are. I mean, things have been straight up. So I'd wait for this to settle out before I look at home builders. Trust me, you'll know when it's time to buy home builders when no one wants them. And if that happens again and you can't give them away and Tom Hayes is talking about that he just bought Lennar or Pulte Homes, I am nowhere. It's not even remotely on my radar right now. So I'll leave it at that. Nick, thanks for the question. I'm thinking, you know, you're okay, but it's like find something where the horse is just leaving the station versus where it's already up 30x is my best suggestion. So with that said, we're all done for this week. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. In the meantime, Britt, make it a great one. Bye for now.
strike.